7:41 here on the Mighty 690 as we get a Wednesday edition of the program underway. And we're joined by, of course, as we are each and every Wednesday, the members of K-State Research and Extension's Wildcat District. And we're getting it started this morning with Daven Rowling. And Daven, good morning. How are you?
Good morning. I'm doing well. Thank you. How are you?
I'm good. I'm good. And we were just talking about how finally getting, you know, into the 40s today, maybe a little, you know, no more ice on the roads, hopefully. But I know James is having the time of his life in Arizona, so he picked a good week to go.
I'm slightly jealous of him at the moment.
We got some great stuff to talk about today. So what's on the agenda?
Yeah. So first up, I wanted to talk about some upcoming workshops we have. Of course, winter and spring is always kind of the busy time for us. Workshop wise, we're trying to take advantage of the colder weather and folks not being as busy with other projects outdoors. So first up, on February 3rd, I am hosting a QuickBooks training, and this is in Parsons at the Southeast Research and Extension Center. And this is in partnership with the Kansas Farm Management Association. Dylan Rapp, who works for them, will actually be leading the training. He's very experienced with QuickBooks, helps out ag producers with their record keeping all the time. So this program will be geared more towards ag producers, but of course anyone is welcome to join us. It's free to attend. It will be from 9 a.m. until about 2 p.m. that day. It's about a 4-hour training, and we are providing lunch as well. And again, that's free to attend. We do ask that you register to help me get a accurate head count for meals. And to do that, you can call our independence office at 620-331-2690. And then on February 9th, Wendy is hosting the OCAN Cattle Conference, and that will be here in Coffeyville. And they have a really great group of speakers lined up for that workshop. Again, it is free to attend. Lunch will also be provided. I believe that one kicks off at 9 as well. And for any cattle producers out there, by attending this workshop, you also get beef quality assurance certified. And then new this year, we have a program series that we're going to be kicking off in March. And it is a kind of like a homesteading focus series. So be on the lookout for more information about that. This will be a 10-week series. You don't have to come to all 10 weeks because these workshops will be spread out through the 4 counties in the Wildcat District. But the different workshops in this series will include fruit trees, goat care, soap making, canning, mushrooms, pasture management, backyard chickens, fermentation / pickling. So we're pretty excited about this workshop because it will cover a lot of different topics and just some different fun events. And then also in March is the Animal Health Night in Independence, and that will be on March 7th. So those are just a couple of things to also be on the lookout for as we get into February and March.
Yeah, and it's obviously a great resource where we have you all come in and kind of share these events and keep everybody updated. But for people that are obviously interested in some of these events, what are some ways that they can stay up to date with all that information and maybe a place to look for more regarding those upcoming events?
Yeah, so a couple of great places to look are our Facebook page. We always keep things up to date there, and our Facebook page is Wildcat Extension District. And then we also have a website, and I can't remember our specific website link, but I know if you Google K-State Extension Wildcat District, our website will come up.
Great. And so I know that that's, like you said, great stuff coming up around the corner with the weather's going to start warming up here in just a couple weeks. And I know a lot of people looking forward to that, and great opportunities to kind of get the spring off to a good start with some great seminars coming up.
Yeah, definitely. We're looking forward to them.
Absolutely. Well, do we have anything else on the agenda this morning?
Yeah. So I also wanted to talk about the importance of colostrum for kids and lambs, because they'll be hitting the ground or have already started hitting the ground. So kind of spring, winter is the traditional kidding or lambing season for a lot of producers. A lot of people think spring and you think of the pictures of those lambs bouncing through the green grass. So we want to make sure they get a really strong start. And for that, colostrum is very important. So colostrum is the first milk that is produced by mammals, and it's also referred to as liquid gold. And that kind of has two meanings. One is because colostrum is a very thick milk, and it is more of a yellowish gold in color than just like the regular milk that of course is white. But also it's called liquid gold because it's kind of invaluable, because lambs and kids or any newborn mammal has to have that to survive. And it's also very important because to get it, they also need it within those first 24 hours after birth. And that's because the colostrum, what makes it so special is it has maternal antibodies in it that help those kids and lambs get their immune system, get that strong start to be healthy, to fight off any disease or illness they might come in contact with later in life. And they have openings to absorb these antibodies, and these openings slowly close within the first 24 hours. So it's ideal that they get that colostrum in the very first 12 hours, but within the first 24, because after those 24 hours, those openings have closed. And even if they were to get the colostrum, they want to absorb those antibodies, which is, of course, super important. And of course, it's also important because that this really cold weather that we're just getting over, you know, those lambs and kids need to eat something, get some food in their belly to help them get off to a strong start and stay warm. So a couple of things that you can do is you want to make sure, of course, that those lambs and kids have nursed. So if you're there when they're born, make sure they're up, walking around, looking to nurse, they're finding the udder, they can find the teat. You can even clear the teat, make sure there's no milk cap blocking that flow of colostrum so the kids and lambs can nurse. Or if you get home from work, you go out to the pasture and you find a new set of lambs on the ground that are dried off, look like they're a couple hours old, just make sure that their bellies are full, that their mom has accepted them, that they're kind of sticking close to mom, and that they're up and going really good. And if you have a doe, for example, that doesn't have enough colostrum for her kids, or sometimes she might have three and doesn't realize that she had the third one because she's really focused on cleaning off and taking care of the last two kids she had. So that third one, sometimes you can get it up and going and back with mom and bonded again. Or occasionally you end up with a bottle kid because of that scenario. Or the mom didn't have enough milk, or sometimes they get kind of rejected by the mom, unfortunately. So in that scenario, if the mom has plenty of milk, then you can milk some colostrum from that mom and feed it to the kid. Or if you have another doe in your herd that's kitted that day as well and she has plenty of colostrum, you can milk her out and feed that colostrum to that kid. The most important part is that that kid or that lamb gets colostrum in those first 24 hours after they're born. Now, if you don't have that as an option, sometimes, especially if you raise dairy animals, you can freeze some colostrum. So you might have frozen colostrum in your fridge, which is always a good backup. Or colostrum replacer will work as well. And you can usually find that at the feed stores, the co-ops around. Now, there is specific colostrum made and marketed for calves and ones made for kids and lambs. And it's usually a little harder to find the ones for kids and lambs in the store around here because they're not quite as popular as cattle for folks to raise. But if you can't find colostrum replacer for kids and lambs in the store, you can use calf colostrum. And that will work. That will get the job done when you're in a pinch. So with that colostrum replacer, a couple of things to remember is you're going to want to follow the mixing and storing instructions on that package for it to be the most effective. And then a couple tips is when you're mixing it, mix it with hot water. That will help it mix a lot better. And then when you're warming up colostrum or colostrum replacer, for example, you mix some up and you're warming some up later in the day. So you don't want to warm it up in the microwave because that will kill those antibodies in the colostrum that are so important. So instead, what I like to do is I pour some in the bottle that I'll be feeding the kids or lambs with, and then set it, that bottle, in hot water, and then the colostrum will warm up that way as well. And you don't need it super hot when you go to feed those lambs, but you do want it warm. And then if you are feeding them colostrum, you want to make sure they get at least 10% of their body weight.
Very, very cool. And I think, like you said, interesting that I always talk about my perspective being from I'm learning everything. I went to the Farm and Home Show last year and I was just overwhelmed. So,
yeah.
But interesting to hear that, you know, like you said, if like the scenarios where the lamb is rejected or the you don't have the proper colostrum, like mm-hmm. it's interesting that you can have those different ways to get by in those kinds of situations and make the most out of it, because I know obviously a lot of time and effort goes into that process, and obviously I'm sure it makes a lot of people anxious when those situations yeah. arise. So it's good to know your alternative solutions.
Yeah, definitely. And you mentioned getting anxious when you're dealing with those situations, and that made me have another thought that I wanted to mention. So especially, you know, if you have lambs born in super cold weather like we just experienced, you know, sometimes one won't get quite dried off all the way, and it will get really cold, it will get chilled, and you'll find it and it doesn't really look like it's eaten, or if it has eaten, it hasn't eaten very much. So, you know, your first thought is like, well, you want to make sure it gets colostrum, because of course colostrum is so important. But actually the first thing you want to do is you want to make sure you get that lamb warmed up first. And this is one reason I recommend that producers keep a thermometer on hand, because a lot of times when you find that lamb, their body temperature is below normal. And you don't want to feed them when their body temperature is below normal, because their digestive system isn't working correctly and will actually do them more harm than good. So you'll want to take a few minutes, warm them up first. At most, you know, it usually takes about a half an hour depending on what options you have available to warm them up. And then once they are warm again, once their body temperature is back to normal, which normal body temperature for sheep and goats is 101 to 103, then you can go ahead and work with them on feeding them and getting that colostrum in them.
Great information on keeping your sheep and goats healthy and ready for the springtime and dealing with some of the cold weather we have here in Southeast Kansas. And appreciate David joining us this morning. Thank you so much.
Yep, thanks for having me.
And we'll have much more with K-State Research and Extension's Wildcat District after our look at Fox News and local news coming up next here on the Mighty 690 KGGF. 8:11 here on the Mighty 690. I'm Shay Neal, and we're continuing our Wednesday edition of the program, and we're continuing our conversation with K-State Research and Extension's Wildcat District, and we shift attention over to Jesse Gilmore. Jesse, thanks so much for being here. How are you?
Doing pretty good. Glad to see some of the ponds filling back up with the precipitation.
No doubt about it.
You wonder, like, where was this 6 months ago? But, you know, at least we are getting more water back into the water cycle.
We'll take it where we can get it.
Oh, for sure. even if it does end up being frozen a lot of the time.
Yep. No, that's, it's, I guess we can't, beggars can't be choosers at this point. So.
Not at this point, nope. but we will be talking a little bit about salt management in the landscape. So because it has been cold and the water that we have been getting has been freezing over quite a bit, lots of municipalities are putting down salt in order to keep the roads de-iced, and this can cause problems in the landscape. So it's important to kind of understand your risks for salt damage in the landscape and to find better ways to manage frozen surfaces like sidewalks or like driveways. So when you have a salt that a city or that you are applying to an iced roadway or an iced surface, not all salts are created equal. When you buy a product from a garden center or, you know, even a hardware store, when salt is used in a chemistry context, it's not just meaning sodium. So when the average person hears salt, they immediately jump to sodium because, you know, table salt. Not necessarily the same thing in chemistry. Salts are just going to be a combination of elements that break down into their ionic or charged forms with the addition of something like water. So potassium chloride, calcium chloride, magnesium chloride, all of those are also going to be salts in the landscape, and they are much, much less damaging to the soil and to plants than sodium-based salts would be. So all sodium is salt, but not all salts are sodium. So when you're looking for a product to apply to an iced surface, usually you're going to have three tiers of benefit. The most beneficial and least damaging are going to be your texture-based applications, things like sand that aren't going to chemically change the plants that they land on or the soil that it works its way into. I would absolutely recommend trying sand before any other type of salt, but with sand, you got to keep in mind you're not going to get that melting action that you will with the salts. Your next best option is going to be any kind of salt or de-icer that does not contain sodium. Sodium is one of the worst things you can have in your soil when it comes to the texture of the soil. Sodium breaks down aggregates and just makes the soil overall really soupy, and there's a lot of chemistry reasons for that that I probably won't have time to go into today unless I have a little bit of time at the end. But it breaks down the texture, it makes soil one big mess. When you have chemical issues or chemistry issues with your soil, you can have either a saline soil, which is where there are too many salts, but not sodium. So you get a lot of charged particles in the soil. You could have a sodic soil, which is where you have a lot of that sodium, or you could have what's known as a saline sodic soil. The solution to fixing saline soils is pretty easy. Most of those charged particles that end up in the soil are going to leach out with no issues. So with enough water or precipitation, the saline soil is going to improve over time. With sodium, it is going to displace more desirable salts, more desirable charged particles on the surface of clay, which is a negatively charged soil particle. It's what holds a lot of those salts and those ions in the soil profile. So sodium has a positive charge, and so it will bond to the negative charge of the clay. And it will knock other more desirable chemicals like potassium, which is positively charged, calcium, which is positively charged. It will push those off of the clay, and you will lose a lot of soil fertility with sodium in the soil too. So if you can, and if you are applying something to your driveway, for example, you definitely want to make sure that they are not sodium-based salts that would then wash into the soil and cause issues. even with potassium chloride, calcium chloride, magnesium chloride that you could apply to your driveway, you do want to make sure that you are not over-applying. A good mix of the chemical de-icer and the physical de-icer, like sand, or the physical traction of sand, are combined to minimize the amount of salts that you need to add, because even with a saline soil where you have those positively charged particles in the soil, if the concentration of those positively charged particles is too high, if you have a soil that is too saline, water likes moving from places of high concentration to places of low concentration. So, and when we talk about concentration, we mean the concentration of water molecules relative to the entire aggregate of molecules. So if you have a soil that is too saline, the concentration of water will be so low compared to what is already in the plant that you might get reverse water flow out of the plant back into the soil. So if you are seeing drought stress, like extreme drought stress, and you know that you've been diligent on your watering, you might have a soil that is too saline. And the soil testing lab on campus can look for things like that to see if you might have a salt issue. And there's multiple reasons why you might have a salt issue. It could be irrigation water that has an excess of these charged particles in the water. So when you are going to water, you might be accidentally adding these charged particles back into your soil. When you do leach out these salts in the soil, you want to make sure that you are not having a net zero like change by ensuring that your irrigation water is quality and that you don't accidentally introduce more salts back into the soil. Because if you're putting down water, a lot of water, that is basically just replacing the salts it's about to leach out, that's just going to waste a lot of time and money. So, you know, if you are not putting ice down on your driveway or on the street around your house, that doesn't necessarily mean you're not going to encounter salt-related issues in your landscape, especially when you're dealing with kicked up spray. If you live near a really highly traveled or very fast high speed limit road, salt spray can travel up to a quarter of a mile, depending on the speed of the vehicle and the size of the vehicle that's kicking up the salt spray. So especially in evergreens, you can see a lot of foliage damage from salt spray. Yews in particular are very, very susceptible to salt spray damage around the base of the plants. So selection of salt-tolerant plants, if you think you have a landscape that has a higher risk for salt injury, is also very important, especially in the evergreens. So things like hollies, arborvitaes are unfortunately pretty salt-susceptible plants as well. The article that I read from Penn State talked about eastern red cedars, and I'm sure if Wendy was here, she would be kind of like shaking her finger at me for even suggesting planting eastern red cedars. In the landscape, when you're kind of divorced from pasture context, eastern red cedars can be an absolutely amazing evergreen tree. They are our only native evergreen in the state of Kansas. We're actually the only state in the country without a native pine, but everyone kind of defaults to pine trees when planting evergreens, usually because when you're thinking about evergreens, most of the time it's around the holiday season when you would probably be using them as Christmas trees if you use live trees. But eastern red cedars are worth a look. A lot of times you run the risk of some invasiveness, especially in pasture situations where there's not a lot of external competition for things like resources, light, water, nutrients. The female trees, because eastern red cedars are what's known as dioecious plants. So male flowers and female flowers occur on separate. Actually, I might be wrong about that. But the important part is If you have a tree with male flowers, you're going to get a lot of pollen. If you have a tree with female flowers, you're going to get a lot of berries. And those berries are what cause the major problems with invasiveness, because they are very good at germinating their seeds. They are very good at being spread by animals. And so in pasture situations, you can get quickly overrun. I would definitely never recommend Eastern red cedars for anyone growing pasture for hay or for grazing for livestock. In the landscape, though, they're really good trees, and I would definitely recommend if you're looking for something like a windbreak. Windbreaks are commonly used to keep salt spray out of the rest of your garden or your landscape. Eastern red cedars would stand up very well to that kind of potential chemical damage that you could be encountering. So just be mindful of the products that you're applying to your property around your landscape and the ways that they can change the chemical profile of the soil right around where you apply it, and also being sure to pick the right plants, especially evergreen related. One other one that you might look into is hollies. Pretty much all hollies are going to be salt tolerant, and they grow very well around here. I have seen some spectacular specimens of holly plants. The only thing you do need to keep in mind about any evergreen is that they are getting enough water even in the winter, because unlike deciduous plants, they are actively growing, and so they can dehydrate very easily if we have a very dry winter like we did last year. But fortunately, I don't think we have to worry about that this year, because it's been pretty wet, which is good to see. So usually with as much rain as we have been getting, at least in the Pittsburgh area, has it been pretty rainy here too?
Yeah, for the last couple of days it certainly has.
So. Okay, awesome. So with the precipitation that we have been getting in the region, I would expect that you would not need to do any supplemental watering, at least for the next week or so. If we don't get any rain after that, then we could probably talk, but we've gotten a significant amount of rainfall in Pittsburgh, so luckily Mother Nature is doing a lot of the irrigation for us, which has not been always the case over the last year.
Yeah, no doubt about it. And I think great stuff to take away, like you said, a perfect time of the year to keep that in mind with the slick roads this week, and salt being laid down, and making sure that you keep your landscape the best it can possibly be as we move out of the winter and into the spring months here just around the corner. So if for people that are maybe wanting to know a little bit more information or maybe have additional follow-up questions or something like that, how can they contact you?
Yeah, they can get in contact with any one of our district offices. My main office is the Girard office, so that's 620-724-8233. Or they can email me at jr637@ksu.edu. That's usually going to be the best way to get a hold of me.
There you go. Well, great stuff this morning from Dave Enrolling and Jesse Gilmore of K-State Research and Extension's Wildcat District. We appreciate them for stopping by, as always. We have plenty more to get into coming up on the program. Of Coffeyville Chamber President Candy Westbrook joining us just after the 9 o'clock hour. Open line starts in about 8 minutes here on the Mighty 690 KGGO.